we are delighted to be joined through the magic of Zoom by a talented actor, musician. Well, he's a multi-hyphenate. I have to open the book to get all of these jobs in here. Actor, musician, songwriter, producer, voiceover artist, photographer, husband, father, grandfather, and we'll talk about the last one, Worrywart, a little later. A new book is great. Danger Will Robinson, the full Moomy. Bill Moomy joining us. Bill, welcome back.
Thank you kindly. Nice to be with you guys.
The book is just an absolute blast to read, and I love the nonlinear structure. It felt like a conversation.
Thank you. I had resisted doing it for quite a long time, or maybe it had resisted me. I don't really know. But once I committed to writing in a nonlinear way, it just flowed really quickly. The whole book took me about 22 weeks of sitting down here, which, isn't when you're covering over 60 years and a lot of different arenas, entertainment, of showbiz. I felt like it came out pretty fast, and I tried to keep it conversational. I didn't want to get too, flowery or poetic or weird about it. And the fact that it was done modular made it flow really easy for me, because I would sit here at my desk for a couple of hours, and then I would go talk to my wife we've been married almost 40 years. And I'd tell her, well, this is what I wrote today. I wrote that story about the Twilight Zone or something. And she would say, oh, but did you tell that story about your dad and the bike? I forgot about that. So she's been around long enough to remind me of things that I might have forgotten. And so it was actually freeing to get this all out, because now I can forget it.
You've done so many things through the years, but it seems like music is the real through line of the story here, starting at a very early age. And yes, you love the acting, and that's been a big part of it, but music has always been there for you.
That's very true. I'm sure we are all capable of chewing gum and walking at the same time, so to speak. And yes, I started working professionally as an actor when I was just 5, but then I started playing the guitar when I was just 10. And from the time I really connected with the guitar, I started writing my own songs. And I always have had tape recorders. And then for the last 30, 40 years, I've had a home recording studio that has evolved multiple times. So music has really been my passion. I make music regardless of it being a gig. And I've released a lot of music, but I don't sit around the house and act. You know what I mean? I love to act, or I loved to act. The business has changed quite a bit. And ever since COVID kind of came around, I've pretty much stayed home. But I enjoy acting very much, always have. But to me, it's a gig, you know? There's nothing I'd rather do than go be Will Robinson. or Anthony Fremont. I mean, I loved doing that stuff, but I don't do it around the house, whereas I'm constantly playing guitar, piano, and stuff.
I loved your album, Lockford, that you did a couple of years ago. Oh. And now to hear the backstory of Lockford Street and what an idyllic setting that was for a young guy to grow up in.
Thank you so much for listening to that album, which was a look back at my very early youth. And it was idyllic. And I'll never not appreciate that, because it was a short pocket of time in the United States of America. And it truly was idyllic. I lived on a cul-de-sac, and almost every house on that little street had a kid, usually a boy. There was only one girl. All within a year or two of my age. And we just were free and had so much fun. And people sometimes think, oh, you poor kid, you worked your childhood away. Nothing could be more true. I worked, I had a great time working, then I'd come home and I'd go run out with my friends, or it was the weekend and we'd go do all the things kids do on the weekend. Or I really never, ever felt like I missed out on normalcy.
And you were a public school kid.
I was. When I was gone from public school I was in and out of public school from kindergarten through the fifth grade. And then I was gone from public school and went to school at 20th Century Fox for 6, 7, and 8, and then for 10th. But I went back to public school for the 9th grade and then the last 2 years of high school. And that was tough. You know, that was weird. I was never a private school guy and didn't want to go to private school. But after Lost in Space wrapped up, and I was quite recognizable in those days, got to remember there were only 3 networks in those years. And between 30 and 40 million people watched Lost in Space every week, a new project every week with that many people watching. It was, when I think about that now, it's not overwhelming, but it's very impressive because of all the different networks and streaming and all the cable things that we have access to. It's very different. But when I went back to public school in the 9th grade, I was 14, which right off the bat, you know, you're a mutant at 14. You're not a man, but you're not a little kid. And the girls are all looking like women and you're still, you know, waiting for your voice to change. So Will Robinson going back into the 9th grade was tough because a lot of kids wanted to be my friend because I was famous. A lot of girls wanted to flirt with me because I was famous. And a lot of guys wanted to kick my ass because I was famous. And I didn't want to be a fighter. I didn't want to be a wimp. And I didn't really know who to trust until I formed a rock and roll band in the 9th grade. And once I formed this rock and roll band with 2 people that I'm still making music with in various combinations, suddenly here I was getting attention because we were good, right? We were making a lot of loud noise. We were playing Buffalo Springfield and Birds and Doors and Jefferson Airplane and Rolling Stones songs at parties and things on the quad and at school in the auditorium. And that's when everything became good. You know, that's when people I know liked me because we were up there playing loud and we were in tune, and that changed that experience.
I want to talk about some of the people you've worked with in this remarkable career. You write in the book that Jimmy Stewart was the single greatest guy you worked with, and he also gave you later on a heck of a compliment, too.
He did, and I still believe he was the greatest. I mean, it's hard to make a list, but you can't top Jimmy Stewart. I had worked with a lot of impressive people before I worked with him and a lot of people after I worked with him. And most were all very positive experiences, but he just laid down the template for how to be a gentleman, how to be a great actor, how to respect and relate to everyone on the crew. And he and I played father and son for, I think it was 11 weeks. And we really spent all the time off camera, you know, tossing a baseball around and just talking about life and having that kind of bond. And he was really somebody I've hoped that I would make proud in a way. And several years, I think it was like 10 years after we made this film together, Dear Bridget, he was interviewed in TV Guide. And his quote was, "The only child actor I ever worked with who was really worth a damn was Billy Mooney." Which, you know, I don't want to take anything away from all the other child actors he worked with, but that sure made me feel good.
Well, yeah, I would think so. Now, you also got a chance to work with Elizabeth Montgomery, and you've given me a trivia question that now I'll be able to stump people with for the rest of my life, which is, who played the second Darren Stevens on Bewitched? And it was you.
That's right, this guy. out of all the programs that I've done and all of the heavy dramatic roles or the light comedy roles, I did 2 episodes of the original Bewitched series, the first and second season, the Christmas show, and then an episode in the second season called a Junior Executive, where Andora Agnes Moorhead, the great Agnes Moorhead, turns Darren into a kid, which was me. Well, I have to tell you, Bewitched was like one of my very, very favorite and regular television shows that I watched passionately as a viewer at home. And when I did the Christmas show at the end of the first season, I fell in love with Elizabeth Montgomery. I mean, who wouldn't, right?
We all did.
so magical. I know that's kind of, but she's just an outstanding lady, and just she just shined, and I fell in love with her. She taught me the nose thing, and she was just terrific to work with. So when the opportunity came up to play her husband, to play Darren as a child, man, that was one of my all-time favorite gigs. And I watched it not too long ago, and I was like going, wow, Mumy, you really caught Dick York's kind of actions there. I did a good job in that show. But the best part was, like, you know, being her husband, driving the car, getting a kiss from your wife, and, you know, shaving and stuff. That remains a really top fave of mine. And she was just great.
We've talked with you before about Twilight Zone, certainly, and It's a Good Life. But you did, I think, for my money, the three episodes you did of Twilight Zone stand among the best in the series history. A Long Distance Call was so powerful. And then, man, in praise of Pip, Jack Klugman was always great in everything he did. But the scenes with you two together were something special.
Thank you. I'm grateful I had those opportunities to work on the Twilight Zone. I still think that's the best anthology television series that ever has been made. And Rod Serling was such a singular talent. And I'm grateful that obviously he liked my work, because he had me back three times. And yeah, those shows hold up really well. And they are creepy, and they are dramatic, and they have wonderful casts. You know, Cloris Leachman and John Larch, and of course, they're all good, and it was an honor to be a part of that show.
And how great was it to get a chance to partner with Cloris again for the fourth time as your mom, but also to play the grown-up Anthony Fremont and have your daughter Liliana be a part of it later on?
Again, that was probably the shining jewel in my showbiz tiara, in a way, because if I'd never done anything beyond that, if that was the final thing I did, to put a button on it, to go back to a show that was really deemed classic by not myself, but, you know, generations of television people that said, okay, It's a Good Life, that's one of the greatest television shows, whether I had anything to do with that, which I guess I did, but, you know, it's quite a compliment. So when Ira Bear, the executive producer of the revisited Twilight Zone series, came to me, he's a friend of mine, you know, he didn't want to accept that gig because he knew how special and perfect the original Twilight Zone was. And I said to him, Ira, you really need to do this because you can protect it. And he agreed, and he started the gig, and he had some network hassles. They actually told him they wanted this version of the Twilight Zone to have a hip hop mentality. So he was kind of up against the wall right from the beginning. And a couple weeks went in, he got a few shows in the can. And I said to him, we were just hanging out. Our kids are really good friends. And I said, wonder what Anthony Fremont would be up to 40 years later. And that was it. We just tossed that out. We didn't talk about it more than that. And then he called a week later. He said, they want to do it. I said, who wants to do what? He said, the network wants to do a sequel to It's a Good Life, and they want to do it right away. And I was like, what? Are you seriously? And I wasn't sure if that was a good idea or not. But then Ira gave me his initial notes to read, which included Liliana, my daughter, as Audrey Fremont. And I thought, well, if we could really do this, because she had been working quite a bit at that point in time. She'd been doing the Disney, the Santa Claus films with Tim Allen. She did two of those, and the Cheaper by the Dozen Fox features. And she was a hot little child actress. And so the thought of doing that with her was great. But what was even better was when Ira said, and I'm pretty sure I can get Cloris. And any actor who works with Cloris, who worked with Cloris Leachman, will know what I mean when I say she bumped your game up. She really did, because Cloris was such a powerful force of just energy that she would never accept anything less than the very best you could give her if you were working with her. Now, that doesn't mean you could rise to the level of her necessarily, but she made sure you got as high as you could go. She brought you up to a place as an actor where she was fencing with you, so to speak, and you had to hold your own.
Well, and you share the story in the book, too, that when you were a young actor working with her and you weren't perhaps focusing as much as you could off camera, that she very gently explained to you how a professional works on a set.
I learned a lot from Cloris because, again, we did work together four times. And two of those initial times were within about a year of each other, and they were the first or a few of the very first leading roles that I ever had. So it's one thing to go on a show and work for 2 days or one day. It's another thing to carry an episode of television. And a couple of those shows that I did with Cloris, actually three of them when I was pretty young, I carried and with her. And she taught me a lot as a young actor, as a young professional actor. She taught me a lot. And I never forgot any of it.
We're talking with Bill Mumy here on Downtown. Lost in Space, we've talked about it with you before, an iconic series. But we learn in the book, too, that it really was, it was a family and a group of people that you have stayed close to for now going on 50-plus years.
Yep, it's still one big dysfunctional family. you know, I speak to Angela and Marta and Mark quite often, like multiple times a week. And I speak to June Lockhart, you know, when I can on her birthday. She's 96 now. Brilliant, wonderful woman. And but, you know, she doesn't hang out. We don't go to the Whiskey a Go-Go together anymore. But we did. and we all get along really well. I mean, we really are like a family. There's a bond of love there. When the show ended, there was at least a decade or more where, with the exception of Angela and I, we were disconnected from everybody. Everybody went on to do their other projects and, you know, just kind of became just a Christmas card thing once a year. But then once, I guess you would call them personal appearances where the cast would be asked to come together to promote something or do something. Then we just fell back into that mode of working and hanging out. And it's continued like that for a good 35, 40 years now.
You did such great work on Babylon 5, but as you point out in the book, that also brings back some tough memories and emotions because a stunning number of people from that cast have left us way too soon.
Yeah, I honestly can't think of another show in television history that has lost that many core cast members at a pretty early age. I mean, we've lost like 8 or 9 of the main cast members from Babylon 5. You know, you never know what you're going to get when you accept the opportunity to be a part of a television series. And, you know, Babylon 5, I didn't necessarily think that was going to be a 5-year gig for me. And the process of becoming the alien Lanier every episode with all that makeup glued to my face and stuff was a real challenge. I loved the character and I loved the cast. We got along very well. It's different than, say, Lost in Space, because I worked on Lost in Space from the age of 10 to 14. And those are, you know, those years, you're just an open book and you absorb everybody. And Babylon 5, we were close, but it was different. But the makeup process of becoming that character and unbecoming that character, taking that makeup off at the end of the day, was really a challenge. And I'm glad I was there for all 5 seasons. I never thought it would go 5 seasons. But we have lost so many people that it is bittersweet. I don't really watch the reruns of it. I know it's still running, and but I don't really tend to look at those shows. It did too many comrades gone.
We had one of your great friends on the show about a year or so ago, Steve Lukather, and he told us a little bit about those classic Christmas Eve gatherings at Rosemary Clooney's house, so with your friend Miguel Ferrer, and then you write about it in the book. It just sounds like a magical time.
Oh, first of all, I talked to Luke twice today already. I have a very small boys group text thing going, and Luke is certainly the the wild one on that little group. We did speak together twice today, quite recently before this call. I spent with Eileen and then our children at least 20 Christmas Eves at Rosemary Clooney's home in Beverly Hills. And Rosemary was a great friend of mine. I'm honored that she recorded three of my songs. I can't say enough about what a strong, humble, talented, loving, generous, down-to-earth person she was. And those Christmas Eves were the best Christmas Eves. And I miss Rosie, I miss Miguel, and I'll hold on to the thought that we'll all see each other again in another dimension.
Your music is taking you to some incredible places. You write about your work with Dewey Bunnell, Jerry Beckley, the guys in America, your long association with the guys you were in Redwood, and then, I guess through Luke, ended up what had to be a surreal experience for any musician playing with Ringo Starr's All-Star Band.
Yeah, I'll owe him for that one forever. That was the pinnacle of groove ball factor. You know, I have been blessed to work with and write with and record with and perform with a lot of iconic people in the last 50 years. And but when you're invited to be a part of a Beatles live gig, right? It is a different level of like fab. And Luke called me up on the phone. He goes, "Mumi, what are you doing Saturday night?" And I said, "Nothing." And he goes, "Okay, well, you're playing the Greek Theater with Ringo and the guys." I said, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, you're approved, man. We were talking about it on the phone, and the guys want you to do it." And Ringo said, "Yeah, sure. That'd be great." He said, "So we're doing with a little help from my friends and give peace a chance. We're doing them in the original keys. Learn them. You can play my 12 string and you can share my mic and I'll set you all up. I'll get you, see you there." Right? And now I had known quite a few people who had worked with Ringo over the years. Some of them as producers who had worked with Ringo as voiceover narrator guy, some who had been in his previous bands, and some people who had worked in the recording studios with him. So I thought, and my wife Eileen had seen the Beatles live when she was a lot younger. And my wife and I prepared, like, what are we gonna say when we meet Ringo? And I had it figured out, right? I said, "Okay, I'm going to say this." Eileen said, "Well, I'm going to tell her about when they came to Michigan and blah, blah, blah. And I sat next to, you know, Henry Ford's grandson or something." So we go to the Greek Theater. We go to the gig. The security is magnificent. And we go to the main dressing room. And I hang out with Todd Rundgren and all the guys in the band and their ladies. And we exchange pleasantries. And I had known a few of them. And that was all nice. And then Luke comes in and he goes, "Come on, I want you to meet the boss." And he takes us into Ringo's private dressing room. And there's Ringo and Barbara Bach. And, you know, it's not crowded, but people are coming in. And Luke goes, hey, boss, this is Bill Mumy and his wife Eileen." And Ringo goes, "I understand you're going to be joining us on stage tonight." And I go, yeah, thanks." He goes, "Do you know the song?" I go, "Yeah, Ringo, everybody knows this song." "Yes, I do." "Well, do you know the words?" I go, yeah, I know the words." He goes, "Ah, but do you know the chords?" And I go, "I do. I know the chords." And he just goes, "You'll do." And then we take a couple of pictures. And then he's looking at me and Eileen like, "Okay, well, yeah." And everything that I had prepared to say to him, It was just like my character in Dear Bridget when he meets Bridget Bardot, and all he can do is like go, duh, right? Everything I had prepared to say to Ringo went straight to the cornfield, and I was just numbed in the presence of Fab. And all I can say, though, that, you know, during the set, I'm brought backstage, I'm handed the guitar, he was playing, all you got to do is act naturally, and then I come on, and Ringo goes, oh, look who's here. It's Billy Mumy. And he laughs. And the Greek theater goes nuts. And we played the songs. And thankfully, I had, you know, watched several of the recent YouTubes of the band. So I knew their little kicks and the little places where they were doing little accents and stuff. I did my homework. It all went without a hitch. And it was one of the highlights of my life. Thank you, Luke.
Hey, I know it's been a big week around the Mumy household here. A couple of birthdays. Your granddaughter, Isla, turned two a couple days ago. And the Peach, Presley Jane, shares a birthday with my wife, Abby. She'll be turning 4 on Saturday.
Wow, you have really done your homework. I am impressed. I mean, I'm really impressed. Yeah, boy, it's good to be 2. It's good to be 4. And I'm so grateful that my son and daughter-in-law and my 2 granddaughters live literally 5 minutes away. I mean, you could walk if you had to. I mean, we're up in the hills, so it's a lot of up and down, but they literally live 5 minutes away. So we see them almost every day, and it's just such a blessing. And you see these unspoiled, beautiful little souls, and they light up when they see me. You know, they call me Puh, and they just come running, and they, oh, boy, that's the best. That, I mean, you know, that's the best. And by the time they're 13, you know, I will probably be hiding on a Valium drip somewhere. But for now, everything is great.
So I have to think, based on what I read in the book, that we might not even be having this conversation, and there certainly wouldn't be this wonderful book were it not for Eileen.
Oh, Eileen is responsible for most all the good things in my life. Yes, I'm very grateful to my wife in every way a man can be grateful for. And we've been together. We've been married 37 years. We've been together for 40 years. You know, we've had our ups and downs. I think every marriage gets tested along the way. And, you know, I didn't sugarcoat stuff in the book. I talked about some of the drama that families go through and marriages go through. And I'm just grateful that we're happy and healthy and together. And, you know, it's good. It's real good.
So for a self-professed worrywart, what did writing the book, what did exploring your past do for you?
Well, this is interesting because I found that, you know, our brains really maintain all of these weird tidbits of ancient info. And sometimes it can be a photograph that you've never seen before. Sometimes it can be reading a card that you found in a box or something. It'll open those files. And I didn't really have great problems getting my memory together to write these things. But when it stopped flowing, I had a stack of my late mother's journals. And that helped with some really interesting information regarding, there's a lot of details in my book regarding, say, I worked on National Velvet at MGM in 1960 for 3 days, and I was paid whatever it was, $500, right? But I would never have known that stuff. The information of the details of this is what lot we shot that at, how many days we shot it at, and what I was paid to do it. And my mom kept all that stuff. So seeing her handwriting and seeing just those little notes would open up those files in your brain that had been really tucked away. I mean, it's not that they weren't accessible, but how would I know how to assess what I did in 1960 for 4 days? But reading her journals popped open a lot of those files. And having written them and gotten it down and to a point where it's like, okay, it can be published, right? Now those memories, and I say this honestly, are retreating again. I have one copy of the book, And I have been doing, you know, promotion here to bring it to the attention of the public. And I open the book and I go, oh, I forgot that I said, oh, I forgot that. And it's once I wrote it, it tended to go back into those files that aren't as easy to open anymore. It's very interesting the way that works. I'm glad I got it out while I could.
Well, there's
so it is true. It is definitely true. I don't think there's anything in the book that isn't really right.
So many good stories.
In terms of accurate.
The stories from shooting Papillon are worth the price of the book themselves. I like the Dustin Hoffman whoopee cushion story, but I love the story of Steve McQueen taking you aside. But I want people to read the book, so I'm not going to give that spoiler away. The story about Alfred Hitchcock and a difficult experience working with him, but also some fascinating information about your family, your mom and dad, that really getting together kind of started a new life for them. And the history there, was it your mom's father or mother who was an agent who represented Boris Karloff?
Yeah, my grandfather, Harry Gould, was an agent in the 30s, late 20s and 30s on Hollywood Boulevard. God love her. My wife, Eileen, was going through one of my mom's purses or something that we, you know, when your parents pass away, and my mom's been gone 11 years, it's hard to throw all that stuff out. And it is for me. I have storage spaces, and a lot of that stuff was just, you know, pushed in there. Anyway, Eileen was going through a wallet of my mom's not long ago, after the book was done, and found my grandfather's business card with the address and everything on Hollywood Boulevard. Wow. Here, you know, right on the famous strip near Musso Frank's restaurant. And my son, Seth, I showed him the card. He went and took a picture of the building. And it's like, oh, I know that. So that's where my grandfather, Harry, in the 30s, he mostly represented directors and writers, but he represented a handful of actors. Boris Karloff was the one that we all remember. My grandfather got him the audition for Frankenstein and then negotiated his contract for that project. And from what I was always told, Boris Karloff was driving a truck back and forth from San Francisco to Los Angeles at that time. And Harry said, well, get your butt down here because I got a good audition for you. And he almost missed it, but it worked out.
Well, read all about it in this terrific new book, Danger Will Robinson, The Full Mumy, a memoir. You can get it at the website, BillMumy.com. It's just a wonderful read, and it seems like you've figured some things out. You've been appreciative of the opportunities you have. You put it all in great perspective here, and it's a wonderful read, not just about the show business, but about life. So it's great to read it and great to talk with you about it, Bill.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks to the publishers, Mary McLaren at Next Chapter. They really encouraged me to do this. About a year and a half ago, Angela Cartwright and I had done a project called Lost and Found in Space, Blast Off, which was our memoirs and photographs from our years together on Lost in Space. And that did quite well. And Mary and her husband, Tom, at Next Chapter really said, you know, Bill, people would love it if you wrote the book. And I found myself pretty much, you know, at home because of the global conditions with stuff. I haven't been going out. I haven't been gigging much. I've been making a lot of music, but I haven't been really socializing. So I found this opportunity of time and I said, well, let's see what happens. And it happened.
Well, we're glad it did. Glad to talk with you once again. Thanks for being with us, Bill. Happy birthday to the Peach. Happy holidays to all the Moomies. And we look forward to talking with you again down the road.
Thank you so much. And happy holidays to you guys. And I really appreciate this opportunity today. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bill Mumy with us on Downtown.